You're all familiar with the Exodus story, but maybe some of what we go through today you've not heard before. It will give you more insight into how God dealt with the people of Israel and how God dealt with the people of Egypt, because he dealt with both of them. And, you know, for me, the story of Egypt and the history of Egypt has always been quite interesting. Pyramids and mummies and all of those kinds of things. I think quite a few people have found that to be a very interesting story, and we still don't understand certain things about Egypt and their technology, especially in building the pyramids. But hopefully what we go through today will give you more depth and meaning in regard to the Exodus story. And so we'll take a look here, and you can see, I'm not sure which Pharaoh this is. I know I've been to the Tutankhamun presentation they had in Chicago, and then we went to Ramses when it was in Dallas. So we've gone to several different expositions of background or of Egypt. So just a little bit of background before we begin. The Israelites migrated to Egypt, as most of us know, in the time of Joseph, shortly before the patriarch Jacob or Israel died. And initially, Israel enjoyed the favor of the Egyptians because of all that Joseph had done as Pharaoh's second in command. And as the years passed, that relationship changed. The Egyptians came to view the Israelites as a threat. So where at one time they had seen them as an asset, they came to see them as a threat. And finally, a new Pharaoh came to power who enslaved the Israelites. And it got so bad that the Egyptians started killing Hebrew babies, and and we're introduced in that situation when they're throwing Moses into the water, and eventually he ends up being picked up by the Pharaoh's daughter, and he began to grow up in the Egyptian royal family. We know that Moses killed an Egyptian and fled Egypt to the land of Midian, and it was in Midian that God called Moses out at the burning bush and sent him back to Egypt to deliver the Israelites from slavery. And this set in motion the events that preceded the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So let's now pick up the story in Exodus chapter 7, verse 1. Exodus chapter 7, verse 1. So let's begin there in verse 1, Exodus 7. Since I've asked you to turn there, I probably should as well. Exodus chapter 7, chapter 1, it says, "Then the Lord God said to Noah," I'm in Genesis. That didn't ring true. Okay. Exodus 7, verse 1. "So the Lord said to Moses, 'See, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them.'" So, you know, God says that he's going to bring them out, and he's going to do three things he reveals here. He's going to bring the Israels out of Egypt. He's going to do so by great judgments. And he's going to do it in a way that the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, Yahweh, the I Am, the one who was and is and will be. And he says something else in Exodus chapter 12, verse 12. We won't turn there, but he tells us there that he is going to exercise judgment against whom? Against all the gods of Egypt, he says, "I will execute my judgment. Against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute my judgment." And that's the title of the Bible study today. So the judgments that God is going to carry out are going to be against the Egyptian gods. And in doing this, he's going to teach a lesson to both the Egyptians and the Israelites. A lesson for Egypt because Israel was caught up in the greatness and superiority of their nation and their whole pantheon of gods. And their perspective was, we are a great people. We are the greatest nation on earth, and our gods are superior to all other gods. And that's how they lived. That's how they thought. We are superior in every way. And it was also to be a lesson for Israel because Israel had lived in Egypt long enough, and they'd lived there a number of generations, and they had drifted far from the religion of their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they had become thoroughly immersed in the corrupt religion of the Egyptians, their culture and their religion, and God is going to call them out of that. He's going to call them out. And remember what happened when Israel left Egypt? It wasn't they received the covenant at Sinai, and Moses was up on the mountain receiving the tablets of stone. And what were the Israelites doing? They began to doubt that Moses was ever going to come back. So they wanted Aaron to make them a god, and Aaron made them a god. And in what shape did he make that god? He made it in the shape of a bull. Now, was that just by happenstance, or did that happen to trace its origins back to Egyptian religion? It most emphatically tells you that they had been greatly influenced by the religion of Egypt. And what did Aaron tell them? This is the God who led you out of Egypt. So they went right back to Egypt. It didn't take them long. And it shows how corrupted they had become in Egyptian culture and religion. So let's now take a look at the Egyptian gods, what the true God did in executing judgment on them to teach a lesson to both the Egyptians and the Israelites. And then we'll end by looking at some lessons for us from their experiences. So this is a display of the many gods of Egypt. Egypt was a very idolatrous society with many gods. They had so many gods that it's hard to keep track of them all. If you study Egypt, its history, and different things about it, it becomes confusing how many gods they had. And, they had somewhere between 70 and 100 different gods. And many of these were assumed to take the form of animals. So the Egyptians considered sacred the ox, the ram, the dog, the cat, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cobra, the frog, various kinds of insects, different varieties of fish, trees, and birds, including the ibis, the falcon, and the vulture. And you see some of these creatures in the montage we have here. You know, you can see, for instance, down here, you can you see snakes and all sorts of different cats and baboons and the dog and, different birds and all kinds of crazy things that they worship. The goat. You know, how many of you have dealt with goats? Do goats smell at all? Are goats easy to deal with? No, they're not. And so you had all these different gods that they worshipped. And it just shows you how far off track that they got. And it is interesting how God dealt with that. So we're going to... God said that he was going to reveal himself to the Egyptians and judge them and their gods by the plagues. And when we talk about the plagues, we have to understand that the Egyptians would have seen some of these things before. You know, they had seen locust plagues. They had seen, maybe the waters of the Nile become infected in some way and the fish would die. They had seen various plagues of various kinds, hail, all of those kinds of things. But they had never at any point seen plagues like God poured out on them. God poured out on them, poured these plagues out on them with a greater intensity than they had ever experienced. So this was something very different for them. And another thing that was important is that God made sure that they knew when the plague was going to come. Because Moses would say, this plague is going to come, and sure enough, it would come. And as the plague would be removed, it's interesting, Moses would say, you know, God would say, ask them when he wants it removed. Well, he would ask, and he'd say, well, by this time, and that's exactly how it would go away. So it's easy to read through the plagues and ignore that these plagues were directed against all the gods of Egypt. But today, hopefully, that'll make the subject clear for you. So let's notice each plague and then see which god or goddesses the true God was executing judgment against. So let's look at the first plague, the waters turning to blood. Now, we see the Nile. The Nile is one of the great rivers of the world. It's a broad river. It flows continually, and it was the life's blood of the land of Egypt. And the first plague was against the Nile River. And we read about this in chapter 7, verse 19. And the question we might ask is, why begin with the plague on the Nile? Why begin there? As I said, because the Nile was the heart, the life and heart of Egypt. So as you look at the land of Egypt, Egypt is a desert country. And you see that there's a green swath here with the trees. But once you get over beyond the trees and things, what do you see? You see a barren wasteland. So there's a strip basically going down the Nile River Valley that's green and lush. But once you get out beyond that green and lush strip, it's barren, it's hot, very difficult to live. I mean, look at those hills out there. You know, if there are jackrabbits out there, they're carrying canteens. You know, there's just no way that you can sustain life out there. So Egypt, as I said, was a desert country, but along this strip where the Nile ran, you raised all sorts of crops and people could live, and it could support a very high density population along that strip. Now we see these homes along the Nile, and the Nile was the interstate highway for the country of Egypt. All of its trade and commerce depended upon it. So what happened to this life's blood of the nation? Let's read about it beginning in Exodus 7, verse 19. Exodus 7, verse 19. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, over their ponds, over all their pools of water, that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in buckets of wood and pitchers of stone. And so the plague was poured out, and everything turned to blood. And it impacted everything in Egypt. And verse 20 says, and Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded. So he lifted the rod and struck the waters that were in the river and in the sight of the Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. So this is a terrible disaster for the Egyptians. The whole lifeblood of the country is poisoned and undrinkable. And if that wasn't bad enough, what happened when the river turned to blood? We learn in verse 21, the fish that were in the river died, and the river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So there was blood throughout all the land of Egypt. And as you look at this as an Egyptian, this is a catastrophe. Their supply of water for drinking, bathing, and washing is now a toxic mess. And the fish, one of their major sources of food, is wiped out. They're not going to be able to get any fish that are edible from the river. And it's a devastating blow to the country. So how was this judgment? This is a judgment against the Egyptian gods. Because the Nile was so important to the Egyptians, they had several gods who were responsible for watching over it. And these were some of Egypt's greatest gods. The great god Khnum. And this is Khnum right here on the left. And Khnum is shown here with the Pharaoh and was worshipped as the guardian of the Nile. And he's usually represented as a human being with a ram's head. And you can see he's got the horns here and a ram's head with a human body. And another god that was affected here was Hapi, was viewed as the spirit of the Nile and its dynamic essence. Hapi was the god of the annual Nile flood that brought in thousands of tons of fresh topsoil to refertilize the land. He was also called Lord of the fishes and birds and marshes. And you can see on top of his head some of the marsh plants that you would find there. Another of the greatest gods of Egypt was Osiris, and the god of the underworld, shown here with the queen of Egypt. The Egyptians viewed the Nile as his bloodstream. It was his bloodstream, and now it was literally like blood. See, that was what the belief they had about their god. And so God said, okay, I'll make the Nile like the bloodstream of Osiris, and we'll see how that works for you. So you can imagine the horror and feelings of abandonment to the people of Egypt as they looked on this river that was so beautiful and powerful and life-sustaining to them. And what did they have? They had a river that had now been turned into blood. And dead fish were lining the shores. It was a stinking cesspool. The three great gods, Khnum, Hapi, and Osiris, proved powerless to prevent this great plague on the Nile. Where were your great gods, O Egypt? They were powerless against the true God. They were shown to be nothing compared to God. So why start with the plague on the Nile? And why a plague of blood? It was because God is a God of judgment and justice. And what have the Egyptians done at the Nile for several generations now? What had they done? They had taken the babies of the Hebrews and they had tossed them into the river. Moses, they had done it from shortly before Moses was born, and Moses is now 80 years of age, and they had thrown thousands of babies into that river. They had thrown thousands of babies into that river, perhaps hundreds of thousands, and were tossed into the Nile to drown and to feed the fish and the crocodiles. And the Egyptians had wanted the blood of the Hebrews, and God said, okay, you want blood? Here you can have all you can use. So that's why he chose the Nile, and that's why he chose to turn it to blood, because he's a God of judgment and of justice. And that's an important lesson. God may delay his judgments, but there comes a time when he delays no more. And when he decides to exact his justice, you'd better watch out, because vengeance is his. You know, you think about that and throwing the babies into the Nile River, and you think of the millions of babies that have been aborted in our country. It makes you wonder. I'm not sure we don't have a river like that, but it makes you wonder what will be the outcome, you know, as God punishes our nation. The second plague, was frogs. It's found in Exodus chapter 8, verse 1. And the presence of the frogs would not have been unusual, because the Nile had plenty of marshes, and they were natural breeding grounds for frogs. But this plague was different. Let's go to chapter 8, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Go to Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. But if you refuse to let them go, behold, I will smite all your territory with frogs. So the river shall bring forth frogs abundantly, which shall go up and come into your house, into your bedroom, on your bed, into your houses of your servants, on your people, into your ovens, and into your kneading bowls. And the frogs shall come up on you, on your people, and on all your servants.'" So frogs are going to be a problem. And the frog was considered a manifestation of the goddess Hecht, the wife of the creator of the world and goddess of birth. And Hecht was depicted with the head of a frog, as you can see here. You know, you've got Kermit the Frog here on the body of a human being. Hecht was, as I said, the creator of the world and the goddess of birth. Frogs were viewed as a sacred animal in Egypt. And if you stepped on a frog, then, you know, and killed it, that was punishable by death. It was from their perspective, something very wrong to step on a frog. They were considered so sacred that, there was a great punishment if you killed a frog. So there are two ironies that we find here. Hecht is supposed to be the goddess who controls birth, but here are literally millions of frogs overflowing the land. So imagine there are frogs in your house, there are frogs in your bed, there are frogs on your floor. Wherever you go, you find all these frogs around. Some don't mind frogs, but you probably would have minded them under these circumstances. The frog birth rate was totally out of control, and they were considered so sacred that killing one was punishable by death. And yet the ground was covered with slimy, wet, croaking frogs, and anywhere you stepped, you were going to step on a frog. So there were frogs everywhere. So I think God here also shows a sense of humor. They literally could not walk anywhere without stepping on frogs and squishing them. And in so doing, they were violating their own laws and sentencing themselves to death for offending the goddess Hecht. Finally, the people had to go out to gather the decaying bodies of the frogs and pile them into mounds of decaying, stinking frogs. And so much, I imagine, they did not see the frog as quite as sacred as it had been. So here, too, God showed that he was more powerful than their great goddess of birth. So the next God here, I keep getting ahead of myself, that's found in chapter 8, verse 16. And in chapter 8, verse 16, it says, "So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth, and it became lice on man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt." So, the witch god of Egypt was there. Was God judging here? The plague would be directed against Geb, the god of earth. And so there, God is shown here attended by two gods. So this is Geb right here, and these two gods are attending this particular god. So the Egyptians gave offerings to Geb for the bounty of the land. But in this case, rather than the land bringing forth crops and fruit and vegetables, it brought forth itching, biting lice. And the god Geb was shown to be powerless to prevent it. So you have this plague of lice. Everybody's being bitten and attacked and plagued by these insects. It's interesting to how this affected the priest of Egypt. As the Greek historian Herodotus, who traveled to ancient Egypt, tells us that the Egyptian priest had to perform many cleanliness rituals in order to serve in their role as priest. He wrote, "The priests shaved their bodies all over every other day to guard against the presence of lice or anything else equally unpleasant. While they are about their religious duties, the priest too wear linen only and shoes made from papyrus plant, these materials for dress and shoes being the only ones allowed them. They bathe in cold water twice a day and twice every night and observe innumerable other ceremonies besides." So they did this in order to be able to serve their gods. They could not have any lice on them. But the problem with this plague, everybody had lice on them, and it didn't matter whether you shaved every other day or you bathed four times a day. It didn't matter. You were plagued by lice, and they could not carry out their duties. So these priests, because of the lice, could not serve their gods. They couldn't even go into the temples to lead the worship of the Egyptian gods because they were now considered unclean and unsuitable to perform their rituals. So this was a blow not only against the god Geb, but also against all the pagan priests of Egypt. Again, God is showing them exactly who is really in charge. And there's again a sense of irony in this plague. The land was infected with lice, making every person and animal miserable. But the priest of Egypt could not enter the temples to pray to their gods due to their being unclean because of the lice. So God very quickly struck down their gods and showed who was in charge and attacked the pagan priests that served all of this pantheon of gods. The fourth, and this is a picture of the lice here that were plaguing them. The fourth plague is swarms. On the surface, the next plague we read about in Exodus 8:20 sounds like a lot of the plague. Sounds a lot like the plague of lice, but it was quite a bit different, as we'll see. Exodus 8, verse 20. And the Lord said to Moses, "Rise early in the morning and stand before the Pharaoh as he comes out of the water. Then say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, let my people go that they may serve me. Or else if you will not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and your servants, into your houses. The houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground on which they stand. And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarm of flies shall be there. In order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land, I will make a difference between my people and your people. Tomorrow this sign shall be.'" As you look at the verses we've read there in chapter 8 of Exodus, it's important to note that Moses did not use the phrase of flies. So we see swarms, and the translators have said that these are swarms of flies. But if you look at what it says in the Hebrew, it does not say of flies. So flies are not mentioned in this passage. So by adding flies, you know, they hoped that they would explain what was going on, because they really didn't know. But I think it's likely, based on the way we've seen God operate so far in this story, that the swarms in this passage were swarms of another creature that the Egyptians considered holy, and that is the scarab beetle. The scarab beetle. If you visit Egypt, you'll see carved scarabs everywhere, like this one from King Tut's tomb, ranging from life size, about the size of a nickel, up to about the size of your kitchen table. So they thought highly of scarabs. But what are scarabs? What are scarabs? The scarab was actually a dung beetle. A dung beetle, an insect that feeds on manure. Why the Egyptians would want to consider holy an insect that ate manure is another story, but it made sense to them at the time. The scarab beetles could also be very destructive because they had mandibles. You can see the mandibles here that through which they could bite into things, and they could saw through wood. They were worse than termites. And was this plague directed at a particular god of Egypt? It most certainly was. And that god was Khepri. Khepri was the god that pushed the sun across the sky. He pushed the sun across the sky. And you can see here that he's depicted as a scarab beetle in the picture here. And so he was that god there that pushed the sun across the sky, is how they saw it. He was associated with a dung beetle because dung beetles would roll manure into spherical balls and push those balls of manure around on the ground. And the Egyptians thought the sun was similarly pushed across the sky by this god Khepri. So that's, you can see that there's a rational reason to have it, but from our perspective, it seems rather humorous to realize this. The dung beetles, you can see them all enjoying a big meal of dung here. They also considered the scarab beetles as divine, since they emerged from dead animals or manure, and thus they were viewed as being created from dead matter. So they would see these dung beetles come out of a pile of manure and think that they magically came out of that. Because of this, they associated them with rebirth and resurrection. And the Egyptians apparently didn't realize that the beetles simply laid their eggs in dead animals or manure, and they hatched out later. It had nothing to do with their being divine. So when this swarm of creatures, I think most likely scarabs or dung beetles, invaded the land and got into everything, like the earlier plagues of lice and frogs, this was a direct affront to the god Khepri. And Khepri was shown to be incapable of controlling the highly destructive insects that were now chewing their way through the Egyptian houses and buildings. And God again showed that this Egyptian god was utterly powerless. I might note in passing that this is the first plague where God spared the people of Israel. He had the Israelites had been involved in the first few plagues, and now with this fourth plague, God no longer plagues the land of Goshen. The fifth plague was a disease on livestock, and we pick this up in chapter 9, verse 1 of Exodus. And this was directed against domestic animals in the land of Egypt. Exodus 9, verse 1. It says, Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh and tell him, 'Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold them, behold, the hand of the Lord will be on your cattle in the fields, on the horses, on the donkeys, on the camels, on the oxen, and on the sheep, a severe pestilence. And the Lord will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so nothing shall die of that that belongs to the children of Israel.'" So the plague was going to be on the livestock of the Egyptians, but not of the people of Israel. So this plague created a huge economic disaster for the Egyptians. It affected their food, transportation, their military capability, their farming capacity, and economic goods that were produced by these livestock. And yet, this was truly a disaster, and yet Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. So cattle in Egypt were not just highly valued, they were considered to be sacred, which gods are we looking at here? There's the god Ptah, was represented as a bull known as the Apis bull. And, what did Israel picture as their god? It was the bull. The Apis bull was very sacred, and you see the Apis bull here, and it was very sacred, and was supposedly had the power of prophecy. When the Apis bull died, the land of Egypt mourned for him as they would the loss of one of the pharaohs. And after death, the Apis bull was even embalmed and placed in a tomb like a pharaoh. And, if you've raised cattle, how many of those cattle prophesied for you? And how many of you wondered, these cattle are just as stupid as they can be? It's just sometimes surprising. But people can be caught up in these things. One of Egypt's greatest goddesses was Hathor, depicted as a cow-headed goddess. You see the ears are more like a cow here. And Hathor had horns with the solar disk between the horns. We see another portrayal of that here. There's Hathor and the horns of the bull on top of her head. So these great gods of Egypt, Ptah and Hathor, were powerless to protect the cattle and livestock of the Egyptians. And we have to keep in mind that as each plague is sent, the Egyptians probably began to desperately pray to their gods to save them. Save us from these terrible disasters. But in every case, their gods were powerless and silent. And these are people that believe firmly in their gods. They believe that their gods would watch over them and provide for them and protect them. And now that disaster is coming on their land, none of these gods seem to be impotent. We have the sixth plague, here, that is boils. We pick that up in chapter 9 of Exodus and verse 8. "So the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'Take for yourselves handfuls of ashes from a furnace, and let Moses scatter it toward the heavens in the sight of Pharaoh. And it shall become fine dust in all the land of Egypt, and it will cause boils that break out in sores on man and beast throughout all the land.' Then they took ashes from the furnace and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses scattered them toward heaven. And they caused boils that break out in sores on man and beast. And the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians and all the Egyptians." So the Egyptians had healing deities to whom on special occasions they sacrificed human beings. And the victims were burned on an altar, and their ashes were cast into the air, where the wind would blow the ashes over the people. And this was viewed as a blessing on them. Can you see how God was impacting them? Something that they believed firmly in. Yes, the ashes were thrown in the air and landed on them, but the results were not good. Moses took the ashes, as I said, and threw them in the air, and all these painful boils broke out on them. And the plague would have been an affront to a number of Egyptian gods of healing. One of them was Thoth, the ibis-headed god of intelligence. So how intelligent is an ibis? You know, they thought it was. It was the god of intelligence and medical learning. Another was Nefertim, who is the god of healing. And another was Isis. One of the chief goddesses and wife of Osiris. She was supposedly able to bring Osiris back to life after his death, but she was powerless to protect Egypt and the Egyptians from the painful boils that had broken out all over. Verse 11 pointedly points out that the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians and all the Egyptians. So this may indicate that this plague was directed largely at them. You know, it affected the religious leadership in their country. Priests with their magical powers, especially those in the cult of Sekhmet, and this is a Sekhmet, a lion with an orb on the head there. Another goddess of healing were the doctors of ancient Egypt. However, the magicians suffered so horribly from the boils that they could barely stand, and let alone use the power of their apparently powerless gods to heal others. So one after another, God is impacting the gods of Egypt. And, you know, as you look at what's described as unfolding here, it's very clear that God was attacking the gods of Egypt. The seventh plague was hail. The seventh plague we read about in Exodus 9, verse 22, this was the plague of hail. And this would have been quite an unusual event because in the area of Cairo itself, they only get about 2 inches of rain a year. And it's a desert, and you just don't see much hail in desert conditions. Chapter 9, verse 22. It says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt, on man, on beast, and on every herb of the field throughout the land of Egypt. And Moses stretched out his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and fire darted to the ground, and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt." So there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it had become a nation. And the hail struck throughout the land of Egypt, and all that was in the field, both man and beast, and the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree of the land. You know, and Egypt doesn't have a whole lot of trees. "And the flax and barley were struck, for the barley was in the head and the flax was in the bud." So, you know, as we see this plague unfold and the destruction that it does, we see here that this plague destroyed the flax and the barley crops. And this was significant. And this tells us something about the timing of this plague. We tend to assume that these plagues came one right after another. So one day there's the first plague, the next day, the second day, there's another plague, and it's just one day right after the other. But that's not the case. It unfolded over a period of time. They took place over some time, and we can know that from this verse. The time of the year when the barley is in the head and the flax is in the bud is the month January. And yet, the Passover, you got January, February, March, probably the beginning of April, you're going to have the Passover. So there are months until the Passover is going to take place. So this tells us something about the timing of things. So which Egyptian gods and goddesses did this sky expose as powerless and worthless? Since this plague was originated from the sky, the most prominent deity was Nut. Maybe not pronounced Nut, it may be Newt, but anyway, it's N-U-T, goddess of the sky. So she's to be to govern the sky and everything that goes on in it. And if she was this powerful being, she would prevent hail and all that, the lightning and everything that came as a plague upon Egypt. And she was powerless to stop it. And she was also one of Egypt's most important gods. She was considered by the Egyptians to be the mother of five other gods. Nut wasn't the only Egyptian god discredited by the plagues. There was Shu, the god of wind. Why didn't she stop the devastating winds? There was Horus, the hawk-headed sky god of Upper Egypt. And so we see this plague was another devastating attack on the country. They had already lost the fish part of their diet as the Nile was turned to blood. The plague on their livestock killed off many of them, and the livestock still in the field at the time of the hailstorm, they were killed by the hail, so now they've lost much of their source of meat. And they've also lost the flax crop, because the flax crop is the crop that they get most of their clothing from. So that's no longer a source of linen for them. So they've lost much of their ability to feed themselves, and they've lost their primary source of clothing as well. The next plague is the plague of locusts. The plague of hail caused widespread devastation and wiped out the crops and most plants. But a few things survive for the locust of the next plague to devour. And we pick up the plague of locust in chapter 10, verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locust, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land, all that the hail has left." So Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt. And the Lord brought an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. When it was morning, the east wind brought locusts. And the locust went over all the land of Egypt and rested on all the territory of Egypt. And they were very, very, they were very severe. Previously, there had been no such locust as they, nor shall there be such after them. So this was a unique situation, it says. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened. They ate every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees and the hail that the hail had left. So there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field throughout the whole land of Egypt. So they had suffered already. Now everything is wiped out, completely barren. And in ancient times, locusts could destroy an entire village's food supply in a matter of minutes. They simply devoured everything that was green, every single leaf and every blade of grass. And again, as with the plagues we've seen before, the gods of Egypt were silent. And you have to wonder what their worshippers thought as they saw the devastation. Where was the jackal-headed guardian of the fields, Anubis? Where was he? Where was Anubis? What about the chief agricultural god, Osiris? Where was he? The god of agriculture. The devastated fields, battered down by hail and burned by the fires, and now stripped completely bare by the locusts, testified to their impotence. The ninth plague, darkness. Darkness. You know, we might put ourselves in the sandals of the Egyptians for a moment. They've seen the Nile turn to blood and all the fish in it die. They've been overrun by frogs, millions of frogs. They've been overwhelmed by lice invading the land. They've had swarms of other creatures, most likely dung beetles invading and covering everything. They've seen their livestock become diseased and die. They've been plagued by boils on people and their animals and the locusts. They've had the hail and fire wipe out most of their crops. And then to follow that up, you've had the coming of the locust. And now comes something truly terrible that probably makes you think the entire world is coming to an end. A plague of darkness so thick and black that you can literally feel it. Let's pick that up in Exodus chapter 10, verse 21. It says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt.'" That's pretty thick darkness. "So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings." So I don't know how God did that, but he was able to do it with no problem. So imagine the entire world as you know it suddenly going dark so that you can't see anything. You can't see the members of your family. You can't see anything in your house. You can't see anything out beyond your house. It's all dark. And this goes on for 3 days. And this was pretty shocking for people in that time because they were used to almost 365 days of light and sunshine a year. Very seldom did they have cloudy days. The plague of darkness was judgment on Egypt's religion and entire culture. The sun god Amun-Ra, and this is a picture of Amun-Ra, and here at the left was considered the greatest god of Egypt, Amun-Ra. He was the creator, the giver of life, who flooded the land with his energizing rays, and many of the pharaohs incorporated his name into their names, like Ramses. You had Amenhotep and Tutankhamun, at the living image of Amun. Amun-Ra, in this case, was silent. He was nowhere to be seen. You couldn't see him because of the darkness. Nothing could be seen in the darkness that covered the land. And it showed again, their God was impotent. He was powerless. The final plague, the tenth plague, the death of the firstborn. We find this discussed in Exodus 11:4. We find here the destruction of the firstborn, whether human or animal. So Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out into the midst of Egypt, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the female servant who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the animals." So they've already lost a lot of their livestock. Now they're going to lose more. "Then there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as was not like it before, nor shall be like it again." So why the firstborn? In that time and in that culture, the firstborn received a double portion of the inheritance. The firstborn generally became the country's ruling elite. They became the generals, the military officers, the chief administrators, and usually the pharaohs themselves. And this particular pharaoh apparently was not a firstborn. In all probability, the firstborn of the family had died, and then he took his place and became pharaoh because the plague did not kill him. It killed his son, but not him. So, again, the gods of Egypt were silent. Here we have Serket, the goddess of protection. Apparently, she didn't provide much protection. She was powerless. We have Meshkenet, the goddess who presided at the birth of children. There was Sobek, the god of protection and fertility. She didn't provide much protection. And Renetut, protector god, the god who appeared as a vulture, the special protector god of Pharaoh. And all of them failed to do their job. And they showed their impotence before God. And with this plague, finally Pharaoh relented and let the people of Israel go. And this was not the last plague. It was the last plague, but it was not the final judgment on the gods of Egypt. There was one more major god that remained to be judged. One more had to be proven not a god at all. So to continue the story, after the Israelites left, Pharaoh once again changed his mind. And he set out with 600 of his best chariots, plus all the other chariots of Egypt, possibly several thousand in all, to return the Israelites to slavery. They cornered the Israelites at the Red Sea, but God delayed them by a pillar of fire by by night and a pillar of cloud by day, and allowed the Israelites to cross the Red Sea on dry land to the other side. And after the Israelites were across, God lifted the pillar of fire and the cloud, and then he brought judgment on the last of Egypt's gods. That God was none other than Pharaoh himself. So the Pharaohs were considered literal sons of Ra, which meant that they too were considered to be gods on earth. The Pharaohs were thought to embody all of the gods of Egypt and to be their representative to the Egyptian people. We see these gods sitting on their thrones at the great temple of Ramses. That was why they wielded so much power over the people, life and death power, and the power to enslave. That's why they built great monuments to themselves and such fabulous tombs filled with riches, such as that of Tutankhamun. You know, if you've ever seen this mask, it's quite magnificent. And they were honoring gods, they thought, not mere men. So Pharaoh's greatest responsibility was to keep everything in order, to ensure that the dozens of Egyptian gods and goddesses performed their responsibilities well so that the kingdom of Egypt would prosper and be strong. But this Pharaoh could not withstand the plagues that devastated his empire and plunged it into chaos and destruction. And he couldn't even prevent the death of his own son. And he couldn't prevent his own death in the Red Sea. He couldn't hold the waters of the Red Sea coming back over his thousands of chariots. The last of the gods of Egypt was tried in the balance, judged, and he died in the waters of the Red Sea. And each of the plagues was not an accident, nor was it done randomly. God performed his judgments against all the gods of Egypt. And none of those gods were able to stand against the true God. So what are some lessons we should learn from these events that apply to our lives today? What are, we see all of their gods, and their gods were impotent. But what are some lessons we can learn? First of all, God takes sin seriously, very seriously. We know from the Passover that sin required the death of the very Son of God to pay the penalty, but that's only part of the price of sin. The severity of the plagues is the measure of how seriously God took the sin of the Egyptians. It's not just the sin of the Egyptians that God abhors. He hates any sin, and especially our sins when we know better. And we can never minimize the sin in our lives. Any sin is serious business. We cannot minimize it. And if we don't repent of it, it brings eternal death. The second point, God gives us time to repent, but his patience has limits. He gives warnings, as he did repeatedly to the Egyptians. But his patience has limits, and eventually it will run out. And watch out when it does. As Thomas Jefferson said, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever. It is the same for nations or individuals. The third point. Many people turn to God in a time of calamity. So realize this. There will be a massive turning to God when things turn bad, when calamity comes. You know, a lot of people became religious when those planes flew into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. People wondered, is this it? Is this a sign that the end is here? But they're not quite as religious as they were at that time. But people turn to God when there's a calamity. And when things get better, they almost immediately turn away again. Their hearts are hardened again. We think, how could Pharaoh have been so blind and stupid as to harden his heart so many times? But the fact is, Pharaoh wasn't all that unusual. When the pressure was on, he relented and said he would let the Israelites go. But once things got better, hey, you're not leaving, or you're going to leave under the way I want it. And that's the way it is. If you know friends or have children or parents or whatever that were in the Worldwide Church of God and were aware of the prophecies of that time, You know, as things begin to unfold prophetically, or they think they are, they'll give you a call. You know, there have been people that have mentioned to me that they've had relatives call because they see things getting worse. But then when they don't, then they go right back to normal. God is trying to get our attention, and the question is, are we listening? Remember that the Israelites were victims of the first three plagues along with the Egyptians. And God, you know, God had to shake them up to rattle their cage to get their attention so he could begin separating them from the world to make them his chosen nation. So he was bringing them out and he had to get their attention. If we look at the news happening around us now, we need to realize that God is trying to get our attention. All those bad things happening are to get our attention. That things are moving along toward a crisis and toward the God intervening in the world. And we can see these things taking shape little by little before our eyes. The fifth point here, let's move along, that requires obedience, not just belief. God requires obedience, not just belief. So, you know, how were the Israelites spared death? Didn't they have to take some of the blood of the lamb and put it on the doorpost? They had to do something. They just didn't have to acknowledge that God was God and God was coming. He expected them to put that blood on the lamppost. And they had to act and obey in faith, or they would have lost their firstborn just like the Egyptians did. If they had not put that on their doorpost, they would have suffered the loss of their firstborn. So as they had to act and obey and leave Egypt to be saved, we have to do the same thing. We have to act, we have to obey, and leave Egypt, that is, this world, to be saved. The sixth point, what are your gods? The Egyptians had dozens of gods that they worshipped and devoted their lives to. What about us? What are our gods? To whom do we devote our lives? A false god is anything that comes between us and the one true God. What about the idols that stand between us and God? Are there any? What consumes our time and energy? Our job, our career, hobbies, sports, cars, TV, music, movies, clothing? I would venture to say that not a one of us has the ibis god in their home. Not a one of us worships a snake or a dung beetle. I just don't believe that's happening. But there are other things that can be gods for us in our modern age. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we have any false gods that we need to remove from our house and reject? The final point is this, way down at the bottom. Our all-powerful God is in complete control. He's in complete control just as he was in the land of Egypt. There was no God that could stand against him. And we see this through the plagues. God controlled every aspect of it to bring about his purpose, which was to deliver his people from slavery and sin and to make a new nation of them for his purpose. So we can take comfort and hope in that, and there's nothing that is out of his control. He's begun his good work in us, and will continue that work so long as we are receptive to his working in us. So we have a chance to renew our covenant with God and to move away from this world and to be ready for his kingdom in a better world that is to come. So hopefully you found this to be helpful as God exercised his judgment against all the gods of Egypt. And hopefully it gives you a little better perspective on the plagues and what God was doing as he basically humbled the people of Egypt and also taught his people the nation of Israel. So thank you for your attention. Thank you for, I hope you found it profitable, and please have a great remainder of the Sabbath day.